Following program is intended for mature audiences.
All right, you primitive screwheads, listen up.
Let's talk football.
The one constant through all the years, Ray, has been baseball.
Been a lot of complaints already. Bad language, smoking grass.
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses. Hit it.
What's up, everybody? Dan back with you. Another episode of the Intentional Foul. Got a ton of stuff to get to today. We've got recap of week four in the NFL. We'll look at week five matchups as well. We've got some MLB playoffs to get into. Talk about the end of the Brewers season and what that means going forward. NBA training camps open this week. Got some preseason games coming up here in the very, very near future. And we will have another installment of Remember That Guy. So a lot of stuff to get to. Rolling solo again today. No Goldberg yet. Still on hiatus. Working like a dog. Calling football games all over America. America's broadcaster, as I call him. But let's get into it. Some NFL stuff. Let's go get in the Wayback Machine with me and go all the way back to last Thursday. See if I can remember back that far to the Packer-Lion game on Thursday night. Sorry to bring this up, Packer fans, but you got your ass kicked. Detroit came into Lambeau and put a hurting on the Packers that I haven't seen the Lions do to the Packers in Lambeau in a really long time, or at least it feels like a really long time. Immediately, the Lions get the ball to start the game, turn it over. Packers have the ball short field, I think about the 25 or the 30, and the Lions are able to hold up and hold the Packers to a field goal. And that was pretty much it for the good things that happened for Green Bay Thursday night. I was really impressed with Detroit. You know, I was a little apprehensive to jump on that bandwagon at the beginning of the year. You know, kind of everybody and their mother had picked the Lions to win the North this year. But it looks like, at least so far through 4 weeks, they are head and shoulders above the Packers, the Vikings, and the Bears in that division. I didn't quite understand what the Packers' game plan was Thursday night. It was very odd. Rookie quarterback, big divisional game against a team that everybody thinks is going to win the division. And you come out and decide that you're just going to try to throw the ball all over the field in the first half. With a patchwork offensive line, Bakhtiari, Went back on IR. His Packer career may be over. You get Aaron Jones back after not having him for a couple of weeks. So one would think going into that game, hey, rookie quarterback, patchwork O-line, just got our full strength back at the running back position. We got to run the ball here. Nope. That's not what LaFleur decided to do. He had his shiny new toy named Jordan Love, and he wanted to show it off on national TV, and it was a disaster. At one point in the second quarter, late in the second quarter, I think the Packers had 1 yard of offense. 1 yard? Jordan Love was not good. But in fairness to him, as I've talked about many times with Justin Fields and the Chicago Bears, I think the Packers were asking too much of him. You know, this is where the coaching aspect in the NFL really comes into play, and probably more so than the other sports, because they're so heavily involved in each individual play call. But it was just bad from LaFleur, just bad, you know. And then he kind of gets asked about it in the post game, and he gets all defensive and snippy. with the reporters. That, to me, that shows some insecurity on his part. You know, you don't have Aaron Rodgers anymore to bail you out and save your ass when you're screwing the game up. And I thought in the first half of that game, that was a coaching issue more than it was a player issue to me. I didn't think that he put his team in a very good position to be successful in the first half of the game. Now, in the second half, they came out and they played better, which is strange because that's kind of been the theme this year. If you look at the four games from the Packers, first half against the Bears, they weren't very good. The second half, they looked great. You know, first half against Atlanta, they were pretty good. Second half, they kind of melted down in the fourth quarter. Against the Saints, terrible in the first half, great in the second half. And even against Detroit, they weren't great in the second half, but they were much better than they were in the first. So I give the coaching staff some credit for some halftime adjustments, but it's just a little curious to me why you're having so many issues coming out of the locker room in the first half. That's a bit of a head scratcher to me. The Packer defense was bad. You know, could not stop the run at all. David Montgomery, former Bear, 120 yards rushing, couple of touchdowns. They looked really bad. And then, you know, you get to the end of the game and you have I don't want to say it lost the game for the Packers, but it certainly put the game out of reach for him. You have Quay Walker, again, a guy who last year as a rookie got himself thrown out of two games for being an idiot, commits a stupid penalty that I would assume every football player that's ever played on special teams would know that you cannot get a running start and jump over the line to try to block a field goal or an extra point. And he did that, got called for the penalty, gave the Lions a first down, and essentially that was it. Now, were the Packers going to come back and win that game? Probably not. They did have a little bit of momentum at the time. But, you know, those are mistakes you just can't make. I know he's a young guy, but there's a pattern here of poor decision-making in real time that has hurt his team. You know, I think it was last year in the last game of the year when the Packers had to win to make the playoffs, he gets thrown out for shoving a Lions trainer. So there's something a little off there. Something's misfiring with him on the field that, you know, he's a good player. He had a ton of tackles on Thursday night, but he's got to get that straightened out if he wants to have a long-term career in the NFL and if he wants to have a long career in Green Bay, because I just don't see them tolerating those kind of mistakes. That's not, you know, that's not getting beat and taking the wrong angle or something like that. These are mental mistakes that you just got to flat out know better. So the Packers, they're going to have what? They got 11 days off between that game and their next game Monday night against the Raiders. So they're going to have plenty of time to try to figure some things out. They got an opportunity again to play a pretty bad team with a pretty bad quarterback situation. That'll be their fourth in five games. You know, and I talked about that last week going into the Lion game. You got to tip your hat to Jared Goff. He's played well. And other than that early in the game interception that he threw, he was pretty damn good again against the Packers on the road. So give the Lions credit. They're a pretty good team. All right, let's get to the other team we talk about, the Bears. Man, I wasn't sure after that Kansas City game that it could get any worse, but I was wrong. It's gotten worse. Bears lose at home to winless Denver, 31-28, in a game that they led 28-7 in the second half. Justin Fields, by far, had his best game as a professional as far as passing goes. First time over 300 yards. He had four touchdown passes. He looked fantastic. Now, granted, Denver's defense is not good. I understand that, but, you know, when you got a guy who's struggling and you got a young quarterback, it's, you know, it's baby steps. It's the same thing with Jordan Love. He sucked against Detroit, but he took some nice steps against New Orleans the week before in the second half that at least makes you think you might have something here. Well, the same thing can be true with Fields. You know, if you watch the first 3.5 quarters of that game, he looked like a real NFL quarterback, somebody that you could build around. Unfortunately, the game goes longer than 3.5 quarters. Goes 4 quarters. And once again, coaching, play calling, decision making, the Bears are probably the worst in football at all of those things. You know, in the fourth quarter in a 1-score game with about six, seven minutes left, the Bears call a naked bootleg for Fields, a play that they had called multiple times earlier in the game, a play that every time they had called it had been snuffed out by the Denver defense. One time Fields is just a good enough athlete where he was able to kind of get out of it, make a play, and throw a little 4 or 5 yard touchdown pass to Khalil Herbert. But in this situation, up 7, under 7 minutes to go in the game, I just don't know why you call that play. He gets hit right as he turns, ball pops in the air, Denver recovers it, runs it in for a touchdown, game is tied. But the Bears get the ball back and are able to drive down the field down to about their own 20-yard line, something like that. So they get to a 4th-and-1. There's under 2 minutes to go. I think about 1:50, something like that. Denver has no timeouts. So I ask you, the listener, you've lost 13 straight games. You're at home against one of the worst teams in football with a young quarterback who you desperately need him to walk off of the field feeling good about himself. What do you do? Do you kick the field goal and go up 3 and force Russell Wilson with no timeouts and a little over 1.5 minutes to go to have to go the length of the field to beat you? Or do you line up in the shotgun after calling a timeout and run a draw play for your 5'8" fucking running back to run into the teeth of the defense and to get stopped? Well, if you said option A, you're smarter than everybody that works for the Chicago Bear coaching staff because they chose option B. It's inexplicable why you would make that decision if you're Matt Eberflus. Now, let me go over that again. 4th-and-1 on your own, let's just say 20. Denver has no timeouts. You're in basically about kicking about an extra point in terms of distance, well within your kicker's range. Your quarterback has played a great game. He drives you down the field and gives you an opportunity to take the lead at home under 2 minutes to go. And you decide that's not good enough for you. You want to go for it on 4th-and-1. Okay, well, if your rationale for going for it is, listen, I know I'm a defensive coach. I know I was a defensive coordinator before I was hired as a head coach, but my defense sucks. And I don't think they can stop Denver from scoring a touchdown in 1.5 minutes, which is a different conversation that if you believe that your defense is that bad, I don't know what the hell you're doing there. But let's say that's your rationale. That's the play you come up with after calling a timeout, is to get in the shotgun and run a draw play? I talked about this last week. I do not understand why every team in football on 4th-and-short is not running the play the Eagles run It's guaranteed a yard every time. Justin Fields is 6'3", 230 pounds. He can't get a yard? He can't get a yard with three guys shoving him in the back? In the back? Like, I don't understand the mentality that some football coaches have. They're obviously very smart because football is a very complicated sport, but they're also really stupid. Either that or they're extremely arrogant, and they just think that they are actually smarter than everybody. That's a possibility as well. So they don't get it. They get stuffed. First play the Broncos have, they throw it deep, complete it, end up kicking a field goal to go up three. Bears get the ball back under a minute. And then Justin Fields ends up throwing an interception and has to walk off the field with a 3-point loss at home to a terrible Denver team, having turned the ball over two times in the fourth quarter. That's all anybody will take away from that game. When if the Bears kick the field goal, even if Denver goes down and ties it and you go into overtime and lose, or if Denver goes down and scores a touchdown and you lose in regulation, Fields could have still walked off the field going, I threw for 300 yards. I threw for four touchdowns. I didn't throw an interception, and I led us down the field in the fourth quarter and gave us a chance to win. You got to be feeling pretty good about yourself if that's the case. Instead, he walks off the field a loser for the 14th straight time. And by all reports from Chicago media, he basically sat in the locker room with his shoulder pads on for about an hour after the game, staring at the floor. Now you tell me which would have been the better outcome. It's unbelievable. I was texting with Goldberg last night. We were talking about some stuff, and we got to talking about the Bears, and like I told him, I said, it's so bad, you can't really do anything but laugh at it. I mean, I probably sound upset. I'm not necessarily upset that the Bears are that bad. I'm more upset at how stupid they are. That bothers me really more than actually winning or losing the game. I don't really care if they win the game. I mean, of course you want your team to win, but like I said, even if they had lost the game, okay. But you can't lose the game the way they lost the game. That's the killer. You know, Matt Eberflus is now 3-18 as head coach of the Bears. They've lost 14 straight games, and during that losing streak, they've given up 25 points or more every game. If you go back and look at the scores of these games, most of them, they're losing by two touchdowns, or at least two scores, touchdown, field goal, whatever. They're getting their asses handed to them, and you have an opportunity to win this game at home, to potentially save your job in the short term. Not to mention, as I already stated, all the benefits that it could do for your quarterback and the rest of the team. And you pissed it away. Then you get to the press conference, and Eberflus is asked about Chase Claypool. Now, Chase Claypool, they traded a second-round pick for him last year, which ended up basically being a first-round pick. It was the 32nd pick in the draft, so last pick, first round, first pick, second round, whatever you want to call it. And he's been so bad and has been such a distraction, the Bears deactivated him before the game. And he was not at the game. Eberflus is asked in the press conference whether or not the Bears told Claypool to stay home or not. And Eberflus said, well, we gave him the choice. You gave him the choice? What do you mean? I don't understand. You gave a guy a choice of whether or not he wanted to come to the game? That's how you run your locker room? Well, that answer was so bad that about a half an hour later, somebody from the Bears media relations department had to come back out and say, no, actually, we told him to stay home. We didn't give him the choice. So obviously, your coach in your front office, you're not on the same page here. There's no communication. I don't know how you can screw up something so simple as knowing that. And it's been reported again going into tonight's game against Washington, he is inactive again, and the Bears are actively trying to trade him. Now, I can't imagine any team in football giving up more than a bag of dirty socks for this dude. Two teams will have already given up on him in the last year. I mean, you might get a sixth or a seventh round pick. Maybe. But obviously a terrible trade. It happens. But the fact that the Bears have allowed it to keep dragging out week after week, just cut this dude. Move on. Sometimes as a general manager, you're going to make bad roster decisions. Just cut your losses and move on. But nope, not the Bears. Not the Bears. All right. That's enough whining about those idiots. All right. Let's get into week four. So, we had our first game overseas this past weekend. Jacksonville, Atlanta. The Jags win 23-7. So, since beating the Packers, the Atlanta Falcons have scored 6 points against the Lions and 7 points against the Jags. Yee. That loss is looking pretty ugly for Packer fans. And what was billed to be the game of the week ended up being a rout. Buffalo beats Miami 48-20. I'm not sure what to make of this. Granted, it was in Buffalo. Miami maybe was feeling themselves a little too much after scoring 70 against Denver the week before. I think Buffalo was a little more desperate for this game than the Dolphins were. You know, if Buffalo had lost, they would have been 2-2 and already two games behind Miami in the division. I still don't know how Buffalo lost opening week to the Zach Wilson-led Jets. That's a head-scratcher. But big-time win for the Bills. Josh Allen looked good. Baltimore 28, Cleveland 3. No Deshaun Watson in that game for the Browns. But Baltimore appears to be head and shoulders above everybody else in that division right now. Tennessee 27, Cincinnati 3. The Bengals stink. They stink. Joe Burrow, he's not 100%. Okay, I get it. But 3 points? They can't even get Ja'Marr Chase the football. T. Higgins, I think he broke a couple ribs. He's going to be out for a little bit. This team is in serious trouble. Rams up 23-0 on Indy. Indy comes all the way back and forces overtime, and the Rams win 29-23 in overtime. Tampa Bay 26, New Orleans 9. I didn't watch a second of that game. I do believe that I think Derek Carr played in that game. I'm not sure, but New Orleans is showing themselves to not be a very good team as well. Philadelphia and Washington, what I thought would have been a rout, turned into a heck of a game. Philadelphia ends up winning 34-31 in overtime, but got to give Washington credit. They've played a little bit better than I thought they would, and Sam Howell has been a pretty solid quarterback so far through the first quarter of the season. In a must-win game for the Vikings, they win 21-13 against Carolina in what was a pretty nasty game, pretty ugly game. Minnesota's not good. I was dead-ass 100% wrong on that team. I had them winning the North. That is a atrocious pick. C.J. Stroud and the Texans put a hurting on Pittsburgh, 30-6. Stroud looks like he might be the real deal. I think he's second in the league in the whole NFL in passing yards right now. He's had a couple 300-yard games. Houston's got a 2-2 record so far. Pretty impressed with them. Pittsburgh, on the other hand, their offense is a disaster. Chargers 24, Raiders 17. No Jimmy Garoppolo in that game for the Raiders. They started some kid I'd never heard of who ended up being introduced to Khalil Mack 6 times as the former Bear has 6 sacks in a game. Now think about it. He has 6 sacks. You know how many the Bears have on the season through 4 weeks? 2 sacks. Awesome defense, Bears. Dallas 38, New England 3. New England stinks. Mac Jones is not good. San Francisco 35, Arizona 16. No surprise there. In a game that was much closer than I could have ever imagined, it was on Sunday Night Football. The Chiefs beat the Jets 23-20. A little bit of controversy at the end of the game with some of the referee calls, but you know, I'm not going to put much stock in that. The Chiefs are obviously a better football team than the Jets, but you got to give the Jets credit for hanging around. They've been frisky. And then Monday night, Seattle 24, the Giants 3. The Giants are another team. They're not good. Just not a good football team. All right, so leads us into Week 5's matchups. And I'm recording this Thursday afternoon, so by the time you hear this, the Bears will have most likely lost their 15th game in a row. They are on the road tonight against 2-2 Washington on Thursday Night Football. I just don't know that the Bears can score enough in this game, and Washington doesn't have a super potent offense, but they got enough, and the Bears have not been able to stop a nosebleed. So I don't know how they're going to do that here tonight and on a short week. And this is one of those games, if this one's ugly, if the Bears get their ass kicked on national TV and are 0-5, I do not understand how you can let Matt Eberflus in the building to prepare for a game in 10 days. I mean, if you're going to fire your head coach Thursday night to a following Sunday, that window, that's the time to do it. Either do it then or you do it on a bye week. This could be the end of the road for old Matt Eberflus. We got another game overseas in London, 2-2 Jacksonville against 3-1 Buffalo. Josh Allen versus Trevor Lawrence. That should be a nice fun game to watch early Sunday morning. 1-3 Giants at 3-1 Miami. This one could be a big time rout. I don't know how the Giants are able to even remotely keep up with Miami's offense. Carolina 0-4 at Detroit 3-1. This is a nice opportunity for the Lions to really, you know, maybe gain a little separation in the division here. If they can get this home win, Carolina's pretty awful. They're on the road to giving the Bears their top two pick right now in next year's draft. Baltimore 3-1 at Pittsburgh 2-2. Kenny Pickett left the game last week. Not sure if he's going to be available this upcoming week, but Baltimore seems to be playing pretty well. Pittsburgh's offense is a mess, as I said earlier. I like the Ravens in this one. 2-2 New Orleans at 1-3 New England. This is a must-win for the Pats. If they go 1-4, they're done. If they go 1-4 and it looks bad, we may see Mac Jones get benched. Houston 2-2 at Atlanta 2-2. This is interesting. Atlanta's not very good. Houston's not very good. But Houston's got some young guys that are good. And it would be pretty fascinating to see them be 3-2 at this point in the season if they can come up with this road win. Atlanta, they got to get something out of Desmond Ridder at quarterback. I mean, you know, they've spent a lot of high draft picks the last couple years on skill guys. Bijan Robinson, Drake London, Kyle Pitts. You got to find a way to get them the football, and Ridder has not been doing that at all. 2-2 Tennessee at 2-2 Indy. Jonathan Taylor is back practicing. I'm assuming he's going to play Sunday. Don't know how much. This game to me is a crapshoot. Tennessee is a total Jekyll and Hyde team. You never know what you're going to get from them. And Indy with the Richardson as a rookie quarterback, he's been a little up and down as well. Excuse me. 1-3 Cincinnati at 1-3 Arizona. Must win for the Bengals. Must win. If they go on the road to Arizona and lose, they're done. I don't know how you could recover. At that point, I would probably shut Joe Burrow down for a couple of weeks and just let him heal. Philadelphia 4-0 at the Rams 2-2. I like Philly in this game, but the Rams have been frisky. They've been in every game. Stafford has been playing reasonably well. Cooper Kupp officially off of IR. So, you know, I don't know if he'll play this week, but it looks like he's going to be back soon. that'll do nothing but help their offense. So keep your eye on that one. That could be an upset alert, but I do like Philly in that game. Kansas City 3-1 at Minnesota 1-3. Another team here in Minnesota. This is a must win, and it's going to be tough to beat Kansas City, but I just don't know how Minnesota recovers from a 1-4 start. In what is probably the worst game of the weekend, you have 1-3 Jets at 1-3 Denver. I can't imagine anybody watching or caring about this game. We got a really good Sunday night football game. 3-1 Dallas at 4-0 San Francisco. And a lot of people early in the year have kind of crowned Dallas as a potential Super Bowl team. We're going to find out here real quickly against this Niners team how legit Dallas is. 49ers have got a very, very good offense. They have an excellent defense. They're at home. They beat the Cowboys handily the last two times they've played them. You know, Dak Prescott needs to prove to probably, you know, his teammates more than us that he can go on the road and win one of these big games. And this is kind of a prove-it game for him and McCarthy on Sunday night. And then Monday night, we got 2-2 Green Bay at 1-3 Raiders. I like the Packers in that game. I would imagine that close to half of that stadium is going to be full of green and gold. I like the Packers to win that one on the road. And the Browns, the Chargers, the Seahawks, and the Bucks all off with an early week 5 bye, which has destroyed my fantasy team for the week, if anybody cares about that. All right. Let's get into a little baseball. So every week we do these podcasts and I send them off to Goldberg and he always asks me, what do you want the title of the podcast to be? Or sometimes he, you know, will pick up on something that one of us says while we're recording and he'll write it down and that'll be the title of the podcast. I think the title of the podcast this week is going to be Disappointing But Not Unexpected. And that's in reference to the Milwaukee Brewers. And they're failing once again in the playoffs, losing two games at home with your two of your three best pitchers on the mound to the six-seeded Arizona Diamondbacks to be knocked out of the 2023 MLB playoffs. Disappointing, but not unexpected. Monday before the series even started, we all got the bad news that Brandon Woodruff was going to be unavailable for the series and probably the rest of the playoffs with a shoulder injury. I felt terrible for him. You know, he had had a similar injury during the season, had worked his way back, had pitched really, really well down the stretch. I felt terrible for him. And by everything I've read, he was very emotional about it in the locker room when that news came out that he wasn't going to be available to pitch. I'm sure that certainly put a damper on the clubhouse leading into the playoffs. Not an excuse for why you didn't win. That had nothing to do with game one. Woodruff was slotted to pitch game two, so they ended up bumping Freddy Peralta up to that spot. But still, tough thing to swallow before the series even starts. So, get into game one. Brewers jump out to an early 3-0 lead for their ace, Corbin Burns. And two batters into the fourth inning, Corbin Burns is walking off the field with his chin on his chest after blowing a 3-0 lead at home. He left the game down 4-3 after giving up multiple home runs to a relatively light-hitting Arizona team. The Brewers left tons of people on base that night. Give the Diamondbacks bullpen credit. They came in and really shut the Brewers down and walked away with a 6-3 win in game one. Me personally, I told my dad, my mom, some of my friends, they were done. I knew after game one they were done. They were not going to win two in a row. I just didn't trust it. Again, last night, come out, jump out to a 2-0 lead in the first inning against Zach Gallen. Freddie Peralta pitches really well through five innings, and then he gives up a couple homers, and you end up losing the game 5-2 again. And again, for the Brewers, a lot of traffic on the base pass, but all singles. Just no pop. Three extra base hits in two games. That's not going to cut it in the playoffs. You know, in game one, the two best players on your team, Corbin Burnes and Devin Williams, they stunk. They stunk. They gave up all six runs, those two guys. They stunk. It's disappointing. I don't know what else you can say. You know, Corbin Burnes didn't like it last year when he went into arbitration, and the Brewers pointed out all the things that he's not superhuman at. This is going to be brought up again, and if he goes to arbitration again with this team. You know, we had everything lined up for you. We got you. We staked you to a 3-0 lead at home, and you couldn't even get through the fifth inning. That's not good enough. And, you know, Devin Williams, as he's prone to do once in a while, he just couldn't find the strike zone. And when he did, they hit it. But all that being said, the Brewers didn't lose this series because of their pitching. Brewers lost this series for the reasons why I've told you the last couple of years. I have no faith in this team ever making a run. It's because they don't have enough offense. And their decision-making, while I gave them credit last week for pushing a lot of the right buttons all year, they didn't push the right buttons this week. And it started with their playoff roster decisions and the decision to put Jesse Winker on the playoff roster, a player who hadn't had a major league at bat since July 24th. They decided to put him on the playoff roster over Rowdy Tellez, who, granted, had a rough year, but a lot of that was due to the hand injury that he suffered. I think if you asked every Brewer fan, if you said to every Brewer fan, hey, listen, you have to mortgage your house on either Winker or Tellez coming up with a big hit in the playoffs, who are you mortgaging your home on? I think 99% of the people would say Rowdy Tellez. The Brewers said Jesse Winker. And one of the reasons why they like Jesse Winker so much is because, and I'm not making this up, folks, he has a higher walk rate than Tellez does. So we're going to put a guy who hasn't seen major league pitching in 3 months. We're going to put him on the roster because what? Because he might walk? Now, I'm not a new age stat nerd baseball guy. But if that's the reasoning, then they need to just light all those stats on fire in the Brewer baseball operations office, because that's a terrible decision. Not to mention, Rowdy Tellez has been one of the core guys on the Brewers the last couple of years. As we saw last year when the Brewers traded away Hader, it doesn't seem like they take into consideration the reaction in the clubhouse. And I don't understand that. Chemistry matters. And this idea of just shrugging your shoulders and saying, ah, they're professionals, don't work that way. They're professionals, but they're people too. So that was a terrible decision. And then to compound the decision, they trot Winker out in both games 1 and 2 in big crucial situations, and he does exactly what we figure he would do. In game one, he sees three pitches and strikes out. And after the second pitch, he hurts his back. Well, that'll happen when you haven't swung at 100-mile-an-hour fastball in 3 months. And then in game two, he hits a tapper to first base. Really? So, you decided to keep off a guy in Rowdy Tellez, who last year hit over 30 home runs and is one of a handful of people on your roster that can hit the ball off the scoreboard. You left him off the roster for that guy, Jesse Winker. That was a terrible decision. That was a terrible decision by Matt Arnold in the front office as far as the roster goes, and it was an equally terrible decision by Craig Counsell to put Winker in that position. Winker's getting booed off the field both games, and honestly, I don't even blame Winker. I blame Counsell and Matt Arnold for that. You put that guy in a position to fail. There's just no getting around it. Then let's just talk about the two lineups that they ran out. They ran the same lineup out both days. Listen, Mark Canna was a nice addition to the Brewers. He was very instrumental and had some big hits down the stretch to allow the Brewers to make the playoffs. He cannot hit cleanup for you in the playoffs. That's ridiculous. That is ridiculous. A 36-year-old light hitter hitting cleanup in the playoffs? He should be hitting eighth. Again, I'm not one of these new school baseball guys. I'm old school. And when I look at the Brewers in a short playoff series when I know I have to score, why am I putting guys that can hit the ball out of the park or at least bang the ball off the wall, guys like Willy Adames and Tyrone Taylor, why are they batting in the back half of the order? I want my top five guys to be my five best hitters and best run producers. That made no sense either. And, you know, you got to look at it. 37-year-old Carlos Santana, 36-year-old Mark Canna, 37-year-old recently cut from the Yankees, Josh Donaldson. That's 33% of your lineup. Who's that beating? Who's that beating? You're not playing the Pirates on a Tuesday in June against their fourth or fifth starter. You're going up against the best pitchers in baseball in series where you've got to figure runs are most likely going to be at a premium. And that's your lineup? Really? Like Monasterio, a guy who, while he doesn't hit the ball out of the park, he hits the ball. He couldn't get a start. He couldn't get a pinch hit opportunity instead of Winker. You know, last night, bases loaded, one out. Sal Frelick comes to the plate. They bring in a left-hander. And you don't pinch hit for Frelick? Why? All year long, you make the move to a right-handed hitter. Now, you might not have loved your option being Joey Weimer, but if you're going to play percentages, and that's one of the reasons why you brought Winker up over Tellez, why are you not going to play percentages in that situation? That doesn't make any sense to me. So, Counsell had a very poor managing series. Some of it wasn't his fault. He can't help that Burns and Williams stunk. That's not his fault. But the roster decisions, the pinch hit decisions, the lineup decisions, I thought they were bad. I thought they were bad. But at the end of the day, this all goes back to what I've been saying about the Brewers the last couple years. I just don't think they have built a roster for postseason success. I think they've built a roster for regular season success. I think they've built a roster that allows them to compete for wild card appearances and to be the third best division winner. But I don't think they've built a roster that has a chance to win multiple playoff series in a row. You look around at the other National League teams that won their series. Philadelphia has Schwarber, Harper, Turner, Castellanos. The Dodgers, we know all the guys they got. Atlanta, we know all the guys they got. In the American League, Texas, loaded, bunch of hitters. Minnesota, bunch of hitters. The Brewers have some solid baseball players. Christian Yelich is a good player. It's not a great player. Willy Adames is a pretty good player. He's not a great player. They have no pop in their lineup. It's just one of those things when you have no star power and you have such a thin margin for error like the Brewers do, when you make poor roster decisions and you make poor lineup decisions like they made the last two games, you're going to lose. It's just the way it is. And, you know, going into next year, I don't think Corbin Burns is back as a Brewer. I think he's gone. I think it's at best 50-50 if Brandon Woodruff's back as a Brewer next year. Donaldson will be gone. Canna will be gone. Santana will probably be gone. Now, they will get some youth infusion with Mitchell coming back next year. We will see Jackson Churio at some point. But, you know, other than the 2003 Marlins, when the hell have you seen a team full of rookie and second-year players running through the playoffs? It just doesn't happen. So then that really leads us to the last thing, which is what is Craig Counsell's future with the Brewers? There's been a lot of speculation with David Stearns becoming the GM of the Mets that is a destination for Counsell. I don't see it. I don't see Counsell moving his family from relatively quiet Oconomowoc to hustle and bustle, crime-filled rat race New York City, where every decision you make is scrutinized 10 times over compared to what it is here. I just don't see him doing that. I also don't see him being the manager of the Brewers next year. I think this was it. And I think there's a very good chance he retains some title with the Brewers, some front office capacity that's more of an honorary title where he probably doesn't have to come into the office every day, because I think the main reason he's not going to coach is he wants to go watch his kids play college baseball, and God bless him, more power to him. He should absolutely do that. But I think it's time, too. I think it's time. He's one of the probably two best managers, along with Harvey Keene, the Brewers have ever had. He's still a relatively young man, early 50s, where maybe he takes a year or two off to recharge, and the Brewers give him the opportunity to come back, depending on how their next couple of years go. I just have a hard time believing if Craig Counsell is going to continue on in Major League Baseball that it's with a team other than the Brewers. He seems like this is his organization. This is where he wants to be. He's from here. As I said, he lives here. His family's here. It just doesn't make a ton of sense for him to want to uproot everything that he knows at this point in his life to what? Go coach a $220 million Mets team that every single time they lose, your ass is going to get torn up on the back page of the New York Times. I don't know how that's enjoyable. So that's kind of a wrap on the Brewers and their postseason series. Just a rundown what else happened in MLB. Texas kind of surprisingly beats Tampa 2-0 and advances. The Twins beat Toronto 2-0, and Philly beats Miami 2-0. So we have no game threes in the wild card round. So the division series will start this weekend. National League, we have Atlanta versus Philly, so an AL East matchup, and the Dodgers versus the Diamondbacks, an NL West matchup. I have a hard time seeing the Dodgers losing to the Diamondbacks. I think the Phillies have an excellent chance of beating the Braves, even as good as the Braves are, because that Philadelphia lineup is no joke. In the American League, Baltimore will face off against Texas, which should be a very entertaining series, and Houston will face off against Minnesota, and that's another one of those. I have a hard time believing that the Twins can win 3 out of 5 against Houston. Houston is just one of those teams that they're kind of built for this. The regular season, I feel like they've kind of figured out that all you got to do is just make the field here, and they have the kind of pitching and lineup and managing that is built for the playoffs. So should be a fun division series, couple of good series to watch. Hope everybody takes some time to enjoy that. So quickly, let's just move to a little bit of NBA stuff. Training camp has begun in the NBA. Bucks had media day on Monday. I got to on the Bucks app and also on YouTube. I sat down and watched some of the interviews the media did with some guys. Saw a little bit of Adrian Griffin's interview. Watched most of the Damian Lillard and Giannis interviews as well. My initial takeaway from it is there's a lot of excitement over in Milwaukee at getting Damian Lillard. And I feel like they're kind of re-energized. Between getting Lillard and having Adrian Griffin as a rookie head coach, I think for some of these older guys, Middleton, Lopez, even Giannis, Pat Connaughton, I feel like they have a little bit of a hop in their step right now going into the season. You know, Lopez and Connaughton both talked about how excited they are to play for Griffin, how excited they are to be a part of his first experience as a head coach. You know, Brooke talked about Budenholzer. Him and Bud were very, very tight. And it was tough for Brooke to see him go. You know, Budenholzer kind of saved Lopez's career with what he turned him into, both as a perimeter shooter and as a defensive player. He really saved Brooke's career, and, you know, Brooke's going to probably make close to another $100 million because of some of the things that Budenholzer implemented in the last 5 years. So, you know, understandably tough to see him go, but like I said, everybody seems to be very excited about Adrian Griffin. You know, the Lillard interview was very interesting. Seems like a really good guy. I was very impressed with how smart he is in terms of talking basketball. You know, sometimes with some of these superstars, they're just really talented. Dame seems like a guy who's really talented, but also very sharp. And I think, you know, as I said last week, him and Giannis and Middleton together is going to be really fun to watch. Whether they win the title or not, who knows? Can never predict that. There's a million things that can happen. But I think this is going to be a really, really fun an entertaining Bucks team to watch. And I had kind of forgotten that Lillard played with Connaughton and Robin Lopez both in Portland, and Terry Stotts was his head coach, who's the lead assistant on Adrian Griffin's staff. So all of those things are going to help integrate Lillard even faster than maybe he normally would, just because of the comfort level that he has with the players. And he talked about that yesterday after their first practice, how cool it was for him to have Terry Stotts there, a guy who coached him for 9 years in Portland. And he said a lot of the offensive sets the Bucks were putting in, he already knows them, because there's a lot of the stuff he ran when he was with Stotts before. So that's a very encouraging thing. The Bucks also signed Cameron Payne to be their backup point guard. You'll remember him from the finals a couple years ago on Phoenix, backing up Chris Paul. That's a very nice get for the Bucks. And as we talked about last week, anytime you make a trade for a guy like Lillard, to get a player like that, you got to give something up. And unfortunately, we had to give up Drew Holiday. And Drew Holiday ended up getting traded to the Boston Celtics, which was probably the worst-case scenario if you're a Buck fan, at least on paper. That gives them a fivesome of Derek White, Drew Holiday, Jaylen Brown, Jason Tatum, and either Porzingis or Al Horford at the five. That's a hell of a lineup. That's a really, really good lineup. That's a team that I think will probably be the number one seed in the Eastern Conference when the regular season is done because of the amount of young talent that they have. But you got to think about it this way. Marcus Smart, Malcolm Brogdon, who was the sixth man of the year. So Marcus Smart, 2 years ago, defensive player of the year. Malcolm Brogdon, sixth man of the year last year. Grant Williams and Robert Williams, two big man defenders who probably did about as well a job on Giannis as anybody can do in a playoff series. All four of those guys are gone and have been replaced with Drew Holiday and Kristaps Porzingis, who is a nice player when he plays, but gets hurt a lot and isn't even close to being the defensive player that either of the Williamses were. So Boston, a little bit like the Bucks, I think they gave up some defense for more offense. Now, Drew, you know, if the Bucks see him in a playoff series, it's going to be a bitch. It's going to be a bitch for Damian Lillard. But I like my chances because I don't see them having the bodies to be able to slow down Giannis. But like I said, we're a long ways away from that. We'll see how the year plays out. There's injuries. There's other moves that can happen. So we'll see. The most disappointing part about the Drew Holiday trade was what I read yesterday, which was some comments from Drew's wife, Lauren. And they were not very happy with how the trade went down. She claimed that Drew was taking a nap and woke up to a phone call telling him he had been traded. There was no information or communication from the Bucks to him that anything was in the works. I feel like he earned better than that. I'm disappointed in the Bucks if that is truly the case. I feel like as good of a guy as he was on and off the floor, helping you win a title, I feel like he deserved at this point in his career to know what was going on. And like his wife said, you know, they've got three little kids that are all in school and school just started. And now they got to figure out, you know, is she going to stay in Milwaukee and let the kids finish out the school year with all of the friends that they've made, including children of other Bucks players? Do they uproot their kid a month in or 3 weeks into the school year and try to enroll them in somewhere in Boston where they don't even really know anything about the school districts? You know, this is the shitty part of professional sports, right? I mean, you know, it's a business. Guys get traded. But, you know, sometimes you do forget about the human side of stuff. And she kind of laid it out there. Like I said, I'm a little disappointed if that's how everything went down. I would have hoped that John Horst and the Bucks would have treated him and communicated a little better with him. My guess is the trade happened so fast that there wasn't time to tell him beforehand. That's my guess. Based on what I had heard last week, where Toronto basically had a deal for Lillard and then all of a sudden he was on the Bucks. So it's possible that was the reason, but Drew seems to have a little bit of a chip on his shoulder. And that chip is directed squarely towards the Bucks. And he said in his Boston press conference yesterday, one of the reasons he wanted to come to Boston was because he wanted to play the Bucks in the playoffs. So we'll see how that plays out. All right. So we'll wrap this up. We're at about an hour. We got another installment of Remember This Guy. Got a baseball player. Got a basketball player. This guy here, 23 major league seasons, 1976 to 1998, 10 years with the Orioles, 8 years with Montreal, 3 with Cleveland, 1 with Seattle, 1 with Atlanta. You might know him as El Presidente, Dennis Martinez, a very, very good but never great starting pitcher for a very long time in Major League Baseball. Four-time All-Star, 245 wins, 193 losses, 3.7 ERA, 122 complete games, 30 shutouts, 3,999 innings pitched. Like you just couldn't get that last one to get to 4,000. 2,149 strikeouts, 1,165 walks. Twice he finished in the top five in the Cy Young voting. His best three seasons actually came ages 36 to 38 when he was on Montreal. He went 40-33 with a 2.60 ERA, 675 innings, 22 complete games, 7 shutouts, 425 strikeouts, and 121 walks. So, for you math majors out there, that's what? 40 divided by 3, 13 wins a year, 2.6 ERA. He's giving you over 200 innings. He's giving you about 8 complete games and 3 shutouts a year. It's pretty damn good in your mid-30s. Pretty damn good. In 1995, at age 41, with the Cleveland Indians, he makes the playoffs and also makes the World Series. He has 5 starts, goes 1-2 with a 3.22 ERA and 29 innings pitched. That's pretty remarkable for 41 years old. Outside of steroid Roger Clemens, when he was on the Astros, I'm not sure I can remember a guy into his 40s pitching that well and that effectively as a starting pitcher in the playoffs. Not in the Hall of Fame. And as I said, he would be in the Hall of Very Good, not necessarily the Hall of Fame. One of the great nicknames of my youth, El Presidente. I want to say he's Venezuelan, and that he got that nickname from his home country. Could be wrong. I didn't look that up. I'm just kind of spitballing here. But really good pitcher for a long time. We all had his baseball card. I specifically remember him mostly on the Expos and on the Indians. But as I said, played for a multitude of different teams. So that is El Presidente, Dennis Martinez. All right, our second guy. An all-time great college basketball player and a pretty pedestrian, mediocre NBA career, but still somebody worthy of remembering. He played 4 years at Indiana under the legendary Bob Knight from 1989 to 1993. Career averages of 20 points per game and 5 rebounds per game in college. His name is Calbert Chaney. 3-time first-team All-Big Ten, 2-time third-team All-American, 1-time first-team All-American, was the 1993 Big Ten and National Player of the Year, led the Indiana Hoosiers to the 1992 Final Four, where they were knocked out by Christian Laettner and Bobby Hurley's Duke Blue Devils on the way to their back-to-back championships. Calbert Chaney, when he left in 1993, and is still the all-time leading scorer in Big Ten history with 2,613 points. I mean, sweet shooting lefty, shot about 40% from three in college, scoring machine. Everybody in my age bracket that grew up watching Big Ten basketball remembers this guy. He was awesome. A guy that I really, really thought would be a much better pro than he ended up being. In the 1993 draft, he ends up being the 6th pick, going to the then Washington Bullets. Plays 13 seasons in the NBA, 1993 to 2006. Spent 6 years in Washington, 1 in Boston, 2 in Denver, 1 in Utah, and his last 3 in Golden State. Career averages of 10 points, 3 rebounds, and 2 assists. His highlight of his career, he only made the playoffs twice as a pro, but his highlight of his career was in the 97 playoffs in the first round. The Wizards, well, no, they were still the Bullets at that time. His Bullets, along with a young C-Webb and a young Juwan Howard, played the Chicago Bulls in the first round. He had the misfortune of having to check Michael Jordan in that series, but he did average 15-4. Unfortunately for Washington, they were swept 3-0, and that was pretty much the pinnacle of Chaney's professional career. But like I said, all-time college player, one of the best players in Big Ten history, and a guy who I had and I still do have his number 40 Indiana jersey. It doesn't fit, but I still do have it. So that's pretty cool as well. So, all right, well, that's all we got this week on the Intentional Foul. Hope you guys enjoyed everything that I brought to you today. No Brewers this weekend. We do have a Bucks preseason game on Sunday at home against Chicago. Don't think that one will probably be on TV, but you might be able to catch that on the radio somewhere or certainly on the Bucks app. But once again, we got another fun-filled weekend of football. Thankfully, I get my Bears misery out of my system tonight, and Packer fans will have to wait till Monday to get their Jordan Love fix for the week. So hopefully everybody has a good weekend. Appreciate you joining me once again. This is Dan, and we will catch you down the road. Let's go Bucks!